It really is. Just such an honor for me to be with you this morning. As Bob said, I am part of the Wednesday Morning Pastors Group, a group that your pastor, Steve King, began about 15 years ago. And for years, I think that had a very small contingent. And now we have 11, 12, 13, 14 pastors who gather every single Wednesday morning for no other purpose but to pray that the gospel would go forward in Arlington County, that people's lives would be transformed. And it is a source of God's grace and his power to me on a weekly basis. And I want to thank you that you as a church and your leadership especially has a kingdom vision, that you're not just trying to build a kingdom for Cherrydale, but God's kingdom here in Arlington County. And I am so appreciative. Steve King is one of my closest friends, a mentor to me in ministry. I love him and I respect him so much. And so I consider this to be such a privilege that he would invite me to be with you this morning. 21 years ago, this past July, through the ministry of Young Life, I came into a relationship with our living God. I have grown up in the church my whole life. My parents took my brother and I to church from the time that we were knee-high, and very few Sundays were we ever out of church. And yet somehow, with all of that going to church, I missed the core message of Christianity, that you could actually have a real, personal, living relationship with God. I don't know how that happened, whether it was the church. I tend to blame myself, just not listening so well over the years. But I am so thankful that 21 years ago, someone took the time to sit down with me and explain how you could really know God, how you could enter into a real relationship with him. And so on an evening in the summer of 1987, I sat down and had my very first conversation with God. And it has been something that has been revolutionizing my life ever since. It is redefining my existence. One of the habits that I began that summer, this is probably too embarrassing to talk about, but because you're not Little Falls, you're Cherrydale, I can talk with you about this safely, I hope, is that up until that summer, for 16 years of my life, the only time that I ever read the Bible was when a Sunday school teacher called on me to read the Bible in a Sunday school class. Not so swift on my part, I admit. But when I would open it up other times, I just didn't understand these words. But somehow, once I came into this relationship with God, the words began jumping off the page. And so I've made it a regular habit of mine to spend time reading every single day. To just maybe read a paragraph or a couple paragraphs or maybe even a chapter. And as I go along, I'm probably like many of you, I highlight different words and different phrases, or I underline them. And then I come back and ask God, okay, what are you trying to show me here? What can I apply to my life? And recently I've been picking up on the habit of journaling. Up until now, I've not journaled at all. I thought that was just for girls. Right, guys? Am I right? The journaling just sort of sounds... But I'm coming around. Maybe I'm being demasculinized, but it's okay. Because I'm just figuring out that while I'm on a daily basis, I've been getting good things, I've not been stringing them together nearly as much as I think that God is calling me to. And so it's becoming a very good habit so that I'll be able to retain more of what God is teaching me here in his word. But there is a reading that I will just never forget. It happened on February the 23rd of this year. I don't usually remember what day I read what, but I will just never forget that day. I'm reading through the book of Galatians, and I was in the fourth chapter, a great chapter of Scripture, and I came to a verse that just stopped me in my tracks. I spent the rest of my devotion time just thinking about this one verse. And the next day I opened my Bible thinking that, well, I'm just going to keep on making some progress, because like everyone in Arlington, I like to get ahead and make progress. I don't like to get stuck anywhere. And so I opened up my Bible and found myself staring at that same verse for another day. In fact, for the next 30 days, from February 23rd through Easter Sunday, which was March 23rd of this year, I found myself reading this one verse. And 9 months later, I'm just not over it. In fact, the farther that I get into this verse, the more that I'm just sure that I don't know enough about it. And so when Steve asked if I would come, I knew immediately what I wanted to talk to you about, what God has been doing in my life this year. The verse is from the book of Galatians, as I mentioned. The book of Galatians wasn't originally a book, but it was a letter. It was a letter written by an early church leader named Paul to the church in Galatia. And the letter is really about some deep theological problems that were happening in their community and in their area, in the whole region. And so Paul, to address those issues, writes this letter to them. And I want to read one verse. In fact, it's just one half of one verse. It's Galatians 4:9. Now, in the Presbyterian tradition from where I come from, when someone reads from the Scriptures, that the end of their reading, so that you know it's the end of the reading, they say, "This is the word of the Lord," and everybody responds, "Thanks be to God." So let's just practice that. "This is the word of the Lord." See, I'm going to feel so at home. You clap for me. This is just so good. Okay, Galatians 4:9. I'm not going to read it from my Bible because I'm actually able to memorize this much. Paul writes, "Now that you know God, or rather are known by God, this is the word of the Lord." Now, some of you didn't sound so enthusiastic on that, and you're just thinking, that's not even a whole thought, Matt. That's like the introduction statement. Like, there needs to be something else there in order for us to really say thanks be to God. I'll tell you what, there's a lot that's right there, and we're going to unpack it this morning together. And maybe I've just lost it, because I really just haven't got to the bottom of the richness that is right here. "Now that you know God, or rather are known by God." That first day, February 23rd, I was able to memorize all those words, put them in order. I've been doing good since that point, and they're just still knocking me over. If you were from the South, from the great state of Georgia, which Steve and I both hail from, you would take a look at this verse and you would think, I know what he's going to preach about. You would take a look at the first half where it says, "Now that you know God," and you would think, okay, I get what's coming. Matt's going to talk about how, because of Jesus coming to earth, because of his perfect preaching ministry and perfect life, his death on the cross and the resurrection from the grave that Easter Sunday morning, he's going to talk about how we can know God. But that's not what Paul is saying here in this verse. As I've said, he's writing to the followers of Jesus Christ there in Galatia, and he's addressing a very serious, deep theological error that quite a few people have been making. And he's about to really get into it, and it's as if when he pulls out his pen to write here in the fourth chapter, he writes down, "Now that you know God." And then he pauses, and he reconsiders his phrase entirely. And he says, "Or rather, now that you are known by God." And that is much more than a semantical difference. He is turning the entire question around. The question is not, "Do you know God?" What if instead of me asking, "Do you know God?" I ask God if he knew you. And somehow we've developed this picture of God where we have God with this huge series of volumes up in heaven. And if you asked him, "Do you know Matt Merrill?" he would say, "Well, let's just see. Meredith, Merrifield, Merrill, Matt or Matthew? Matt. There's a lot of them. Which one?" And if that is your view of God, then I completely understand why he would be very unimportant in your life. It's a picture of an aloof and apathetic creator. And our God is so different than that. Do you know what's so wrong with that picture of a God who's kind of losing it, who's just flipping through a book looking for a name? It's not the fact that we've taken the God who's omnipotent, who knows everything, and made him appear as if he has dementia. That is not right, it's not correct, it's not good. But there is a bigger theological problem with that viewpoint of God. It's that we've misrepresented his character. Because it is my assertion that if you would ask God, "Do you know Matt Merrill?" that he would say to you, "Did you say Matt Merrill? I love that guy. He is my son. Oh, let me just tell you about him because he's my child and I love him. Yvonne Reed, she is my daughter. Kendall Lord, he is my son." And one of the things that Paul is pointing out here is that when it comes to understanding a relationship with the creator of the universe, who is a better authority, you or God? Well, God, huh? Which means it's a much wiser question to ask him whether he knows you than vice versa. In the summer of 1993, REM was the hottest band on the planet. They were about to launch a world tour, and it just so happened that frontman Michael Stipe was dating a very good friend of mine, someone who I worked with, and so I found myself hanging out with him and the rest of the band pretty much for that whole summer as they prepared to launch the biggest world tour that they would ever make. I remember every single time that I was with them. Do you think that he remembers meeting me? No, 15 years later, I'm sure that my name has yet to cross his mind again. He's met hundreds of thousands of people and has forgotten more names than I will ever know. And yet, if you've been adopted by God through faith, and I ask God about you, he could tell me every detail of your life. And it's not just because he knows everything, but because he is keenly interested in you. And that's just worth considering. It's a good thing not to just know about God and not just to even know God, but even more so to be known by God. You see, it's one thing for you to walk away from a devotion time thinking, well, that was just so inspiring. I read some of the Bible and it made so much sense, and I prayed, and in that time of prayer, it just seems as if my problems, they just began to shrink and life came back into focus. You see, that is a good thing. It's awesome when you walk away from a devotion time inspired and in love with God. And I so much hope that that is your experience. But it is a much bigger deal when God walks away from the exact same time thinking, well, that was just so good. I love to spend time with her because, well, she's my daughter. And did you hear what she said? Did you hear what she said when she read my love letter to her? I think I'll just spend the rest of the day just watching her because I just can't help it. Now that you know God, or rather, are known by God, it is just an amazing verse. And the more that I studied it, the more I just began to wonder, well, what else have I been just overlooking in the Bible? And it's really opened up my eyes to this method of just meditating on Scripture. In August, I was away on vacation, and I was reading through the Psalms, and I came to Psalm 63, which we read responsively earlier this morning, and I found that I had found a kindred spirit right there in the psalmist. Here's a psalm about a man who has been found by God in his amazing love, and he writes, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water." Here's a man who's literally living out in the desert at the time that he writes these words. And it just hits him one day. Hey, just as my body is longing for water to refresh me and to satisfy me and to rejuvenate my energy, I need God in that exact same way. I'm looking around me, and it seems like I'm looking for a person. No, maybe not a person, maybe a company. No, not a company, maybe an idea. I'm just looking for anything that will satisfy my soul, and I'm just not finding it. I've searched in lots of different pools looking for refreshment, and I'm just not finding it. And I feel empty, and I feel drained, and I need something, and I'm willing to try anything because I'm just dying of thirst. Has anyone here been there? Maybe that's why you showed up here this morning. Because you are just searching for hope, or you are searching for meaning, or you're searching for refreshment, or you're searching for love. Or maybe you don't even know what you're searching for, but you just know that your soul is just thirsty all of the time. And as sure as I'm standing here right now, I can tell you that what you are searching for is a connection with God. And it will happen when you take time to explore and to celebrate Him, when you worship. Next, the psalmist writes, "I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory." And once again, this is a picture of us. It is a picture of a person who would say of God, "There have been times that I have just experienced you so richly. There's sometimes that I come to church and I feel things or I just sense things. And I can't explain them, but I know, God, it's you at work. And God, God, I need you. Because when I experience you, life is just better even when my experiences don't make sense. Then we come to this verse 3, and it's an amazing verse. Because your love is better than life, my lips will glorify you. And this is the one that just knocked me over. Have you noticed this one? This is probably a line that you've either said or sung 10 dozen times. The psalmist is saying, your love is better than life. When this guy takes the time to work it all out, when he digs down deep to the bottom of the well and figures out what God's love is like, he just says, is in fact better than life itself. I'd rather be dead than to be without your love. In one compact phrase, there are three different, very meaningful interpretations. And I think all of them are things that we should be applying. The first way that you could read this phrase is you could read it as a word of praise. You could also read this as a word of truth, or else you could read this as a calling. And I actually think that we should be reading it all three ways. First, as a word of praise, just saying, God, I want to celebrate your love. I want to celebrate the way that you've made it real to me. And so I'm just going to say, it is better than life. A word of truth. Empirically, when I consider these two things, life itself and your love, when I weigh them in the scales, in honest scales, I know that your love is in fact, empirically, better than life. That is how good it is. Thirdly, as a calling, my natural inclination is to value my life above everything else. Maybe that's your inclination too. We are amazingly selfish creatures. And so we tend to do everything that we can to perfect and to protect and to look after that which belongs to us. But the calling that's right here in this verse is to say to God, well, my natural inclination is to value my life above everything else. In light of this truth, my desire is to respect and to celebrate and to declare to anyone who will listen to me that your love is in fact better than life. And the psalmist just continues. Listen to just the joy he's taking in God's love. I will praise you as long as I live, and in your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise you. On my bed I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night. Because you are my help, I will sing under the shadow of your wings. My soul clings to you, and your right hand, it upholds me. It's a picture of the person who's just fallen deeply in love with the love of God, responding to his compelling love, not that we first loved him, but more importantly, that he has first loved us. Now, I believe that there are very practical implications of these two sets of verses. The verse that we have just talked about, that your love is better than life, and then going back to the fact that we are known by God. You can probably come up with a dozen different implications for your life, but I want to mention three that I've come up with. The first one is this, that I don't have to do something great to get God's attention. Neither do you. And isn't this good news? Because as much as I want his attention and his companionship, he wants those things more than I do. And this is just what's so radically different about Christianity. Lots of times people try and list Christianity among the world religions, and it just doesn't fit very well because religions, by their nature, are a set of practices that people do in order to commune with or in order to get connection with some supreme being or beings. That's not the history, it's not the theology, it's not what Jesus teaches us about Christianity. He teaches us that Christianity is primarily about a relationship, that even God is about a relationship. The Trinity, always existing in perfect community with one another, invites us into that community. And we just have a God who is crazy in love with people. I want you to think about how different this is than the way that we go about dating. Think about dating. If you're in that juncture, this will be very cute to you. If you're married, maybe think back to it. If you kind of check that whole thing off, praise be to God. But if you think back to when you're trying to attract a spouse, I mean, you'll do almost anything to get their attention, won't you? You'll dress a certain way. You'll comb your hair a certain way. I mean, you'll take, you know, ladies an hour in the bathroom trying to get ready so that you look perfect for him. And he'll notice. But we don't have to do anything to get God's attention. It's not as if we have to go way out of our way to get attention from God, because we already have it. He is keenly interested in us. And then there's the flip side of that. And that is that there's no way that we can mess it up either. Does anyone remember an old Saturday Night Live skit called Deep Thoughts with Jack Handy? You don't have to raise your hand big time. A couple laughs there. It was one of my favorite sketches when I watched the show. And one of my favorite lines from it, it was kind of very random thoughts, as you'll see. But my favorite line was this: Lori was offended when I used the word puke. But to me, that's what her dinner tasted like. A line like that can be a relationship ender, can it? I mean, just don't pull that one out on a date, guys. That is just not going to pull it out. But there's nothing that you could do or say that would make God wish that he had never loved you. When he adopts you as his child, it's a forever adoption. And he does so knowing full well the types of things that you sometimes do, and the types of things that you sometimes don't do, and the types of things that go through your mind all the day long. And yet he doesn't regret his love for you. Rather, out of a rich storehouse of love for you, he has made a decision. He decided that it was worth for you for him to send his one and only son. It was worth him giving his life just so that we could be secure in our relationship with God. Because even when I doubt the relationship, he doesn't. He knows, and I'm glad that I exist. And it's not because I deserve that, because I don't, but because he is full of love. Second implication is this: I know that I can trust God even when everything else in my life is out of control. Because he knows me, and because he loves me, and because he is who he is, I can trust him even when every other aspect of my life is falling apart. Jesus said very clearly to his disciples, John recorded it, John 16:33. He said, "I have told you these things so that you may have peace, because in this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world." Unfortunately, there are only two types of people in our world. There are people who are going through very, very, very difficult circumstances, and then there are people who are about to go through very, very, very difficult circumstances. And so Jesus says, even on that day, on those days, I love you and I care for you and I will walk through that with you. Because life is difficult, and if you haven't figured that out, then you're just not paying attention. You remember all that buzz coming into Y2K? The year 2000, we were going to switch from 1999 to 2000, and all the computer scientists were really uptight and it worked out okay. I had no idea that the switch into the year 2000 would switch into the roughest year of my life to date. Very early in the year, my sister-in-law at age 25 was diagnosed with an incredibly aggressive form of cancer. About a month after that, it was revealed kind of to the whole family that my parents' marriage of 25 years was incredibly on the rocks and falling apart as we watched it. In November of 1999, I had moved from Jacksonville, Florida to Charlotte, North Carolina to enter into a dream job. By March, I knew that my dream job was the worst job I would ever have in my whole life, and I was looking for a way out. Everything was coming unglued, and I wasn't sure if I could depend on anything or anyone except God. Because even when everything else is way out of control, he still loves us. And out of his deep compassion, he ended up reaching into my parents' marriage and saving it. And he rescued my sister-in-law from cancer. And he actually gave me a better job. But even if he wouldn't have, even if he wouldn't have, he would still be the God who loved me. third implication, I don't have to do my Christian duties to make sure that God blesses me. Let me just call it the way I see it. When I sit down with people and when I counsel people, all too often, we slip from this theology of grace and coming to God in faith, and faith alone, into a theology of works again. We act as if we need to kind of make sure that we do our duties to God so that it's like paying our bills. And sometimes even if you don't think that way, you end up acting that way. You think, well, I have a big interview in the morning, so tomorrow morning I'm going to set my alarm extra early, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to pray extra long. That way I'll get a better chance of getting it. Because our logic goes something like this. Well, if you don't pay your electric bill, then what happens? They cut it off. And if you don't pray before the Big John interview, then? Seriously? That's not our theology. Our theology is not, well, I'm going to do something good for God, that way he'll owe me. That's not it at all. God doesn't help you based on whether or not you've prayed enough. He does things for you out of love. Not because something you've done for him makes it that he owes you something. That type of relationship would be something like me going home this afternoon and saying to my wife, well, I raked the leaves yesterday, and so you have to make me dinner tonight. I'd be eating at Taco Bell, I think. If she makes dinner for me this evening, it's because she loves me, not because of anything I've done for her. And the reason that you pray for before the interview is not so that he will owe you a favor, but because he's excited about the opportunity. He also knows whether the position will ultimately be right for you. And he can give you some really good guidance there. And do you know what? He is for you. We have a God who is for you. Do you know that even more than you are for yourself, we have a God who's for you. I want you to take some time later on today to think that one all the way through. That when it comes to everybody who's in existence, that the person who's mainly for you isn't you. That even more than you care about yourself, that you have a God who cares more about you than you care for you. That's how much he loves you. And so the reason that we keep the Ten Commandments isn't so that we won't feel guilty because we might get caught, but because it pains our heart to think about displeasing the one who loves us the most. You can practice good spiritual disciplines and avoid sin simply because you want to value him like he values you. It doesn't have to be a duty. Now that you know God, or rather, now that you are known by God. You see, there's just a world of difference between those two statements. And if you go away with anything today, I want you to know that you have a God who's madly in love with you, and that his extent of love is deeper than you will ever be able to experience in not only this lifetime, but even in eternity. I don't think that we will ever get to the height or the depth or the breadth of God's love for us. And so if you've never responded to that compelling love, maybe today would be the day that you would begin that relationship where you would just say, if you love me that much, I want to know you. Or maybe it's just time for some of us to just get reignited in our great love for God so that we could declare, because your love is better than life, I'm going to take these lips, I'm going to take these hands, I'm going to take these feet, I'm going to use my life to glorify you. Let's pray that God would do that. Lord, if there's somebody in the room today who has just come in with a very, very thirsty soul, I pray that this would be a time of refreshment for them, that they would discover the depth and the refreshment of your love, that they would connect with you in a profound way, whether this would be for the first time or maybe just the first time in a while. We thank you that you are a God who is full of love and compassion for his people, because we wouldn't stand a chance any other way. And so we do declare that your love is in fact better than life. And help us with the rest of this time of worship, but even in the rest of our week and the rest of our lives, to just make it evident that we value you above all, because you've already proven that you value us above everything else, even giving us your one and only Son. It's in his name that we pray. Amen.